You're listening to the Morbid Curiosities podcast. We have no truck with profanity here, but those of you of a more squeamish disposition may wish to exercise caution before tuning in. Hello, and welcome to Morbid Curiosities, a new show about the morbidly curious for the curiously morbid. I'm your host, George Colley.
And I'm your other host, Rosie Cole. We're the principal performers and creators of Jim Crack Productions, a live theatre and performance company. And in our creation, we research morbid topics and we love to share our research with you.
We love to think and talk and share about death.
I've actually been thinking a lot about death this week because I went to an amazing talk at Sutton House about death activism as part of the exhibition Life, Death, Whatever.
That was the founder of Death Cafe, wasn't it?
Talking? Yes. Yeah.
John Underwood.
Yeah, he was talking. It was really, really good. I highly recommend it if you want to go. They've got events on all month and they've got a great art exhibition. So if you like what we're talking about, go check them out.
Wonderful. It's up in East London?
It's in Hackney, yeah.
In Hackney, yeah.
Yeah, about 5 minute walk from the station. Sutton House. So today, I get to start because I have the letter E, which is for exhumation.
Exhumation? What on earth does that mean?
Digging people up.
Did you get that on earth?
I didn't get it, but now okay. I do. That was really good.
So tell me about exhumation.
The first question that I'm going to posit that requires an answer is, why would you dig up a body?
To give it a hug.
That's an interesting reason, but not one of the reasons I was expecting. And one possibly, last hug. Possibly not something that would fly legally.
I got a real guess then, as to why.
Yeah.
Murder most foul.
Yes. Investigations. A court has ordered a further investigation. It's one of the reasons we dig up a body. Another reason is if the remains need to be transferred from one cemetery scheduled for development to another.
Oh, that must be a bit of an operation.
Yeah. And apparently you can move your loved one's grave and dig them up and take them with you if you move house and you want them to continue being near you. Yeah.
I know someone who's moved house 5 times in the last 2 years. Would they, do you think they'd go through the bother?
Well, exhumations are quite rare and they tend to be quite traumatic for everyone involved. So they can take a long time to arrange and are usually quite expensive, around $2,500, and you have to go through all kinds of official legal processes to be able to dig someone up.
Oh, so, imagine the red tape.
Yeah, exactly. There's tons of it. So I wouldn't think that your person who's moved 5 times would have done that every single time.
Fair.
It would have taken a really long time. They probably would have moved house again by that point. There are other reasons people used to dig up graves, though.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I can see that glint in your eye. We're moving on to one of your favourites.
Yes. Yeah, every topic seems to be my favourite every week. But I like this one because, again, we're talking about the 18th and 19th centuries.
Hooray.
Whose favourite period in history is that? Mine. So, back in the 18th and 19th centuries, there used to be people called resurrection men. Mm-hmm. Grave robbers! That's another reason you dig people up, to steal stuff. Except they didn't just dig people up to steal their stuff, they actually dug people up to steal people.
No!
Yeah, they wanted bodies. Dead bodies.
To play with?
No.
To make Frankensteins?
No.
To sell to doctors?
Exactly.
Got it in three.
Why did people need corpses? The eternal question. Why do people need fresh corpses?
Practice.
Yes.
Yeah?
So human cadavers have been dissected by physicians since the 3rd century BCE. But throughout history, religious views on what to do with corpses have prohibited dissection in many ways, particularly Judeo-Christian religions.
That seems to be a theme that we're running into quite a lot already, that religious practices really, really do have a lot to say when it comes to what you're allowed to do with the body.
A lot, living and dead. The Christian church actually forbade any kind of human dissection until the 14th century, and that was when the first recorded anatomization of a cadaver took place in Bologna, Italy. But until then, it was limited to research on animals, which, while it was useful, was not particularly progressive in terms of helping us out and understanding the human body.
You can get in bad trouble if all you've ever dissected is octopus. And then you
then you try it on a human.
You got to do a liverectomy.
So that may slightly explain why we had such a terrible understanding of the human body and thought that if we bled people, that would make them better. Hint, hint, guys, really doesn't. In Britain, it was actually illegal until 1506 when King James IV of Scotland gave his permission to the barber surgeons of Edinburgh, allowing them to dissect the bodies, but only of certain executed criminals.
Good man.
And England followed in 1540. This is before grave robbing really became a thing. Elizabeth I also granted the College of Physicians the right to anatomise 4 felons annually in 1564. So that's all the medical schools were allowed was 4 bodies per year.
I'm going to guess that by the end of the year, those bodies did not look too good.
I think they got through them pretty quick. So the only legal supply of corpses for anatomical purposes in the UK were criminals condemned to death.
Right.
Specifically condemned to death. You couldn't just be like, hey, look, a criminal. Well, let's cut them up. They had to be on death row. So this did not provide enough corpses for all the anatomical schools, the medical schools at all. People had to get creative. And during the 18th century, hundreds of people had been executed for really trivial crimes. But by the 19th century, only about 55 people per year were being sentenced to capital punishment. So this didn't really keep up with demand, because by the 1800s, every year, the medical schools needed in total about 500 cadavers per year.
That's a bit of a jump.
So you're looking at a pretty big deficit there. We don't have any particularly reliable figures for the number of dissections, considering that there were very prescribed numbers about how many were legally allowed to be done. One figure we have is from 1826, where 592 bodies were dissected by 701 students. But considering that around that time only 52 to 55 people per year received the death penalty, doesn't really add up.
There's a fair bit of foul play going on.
So as I'm sure you can imagine, because of the demand, a business sprang up in providing corpses to medical schools. And thus, the grave robbers, resurrection men, were born.
People are nothing if not entrepreneurial.
Oh, yeah, super entrepreneurial. You could actually get really good money for corpses.
I bet. You still can, I've heard.
It really started becoming commonplace in the early 1700s, by about the 1720s. They were actually traded like any other merchandise. They were packed into containers, they were salted and preserved, they could be stored in cellars, in quays, in carts, transported in wagons and boats. And anatomy schools started to compete with their peers. So they would actually pay competitive prices for fresh corpses. So they had different prices, and you could get something like 8 guineas for a corpse.
Which is
quite a lot of money.
Okay, that's some thousands, I guess.
Yeah, I think it was about 500 quid. Any historians like to tell me how much 8 guineas was worth in the 1700s? Tweet me, please, at Jim Crack Shows. Other people who might need them would be individual surgeons, artists with an interest in anatomy, and anyone who is particularly interested in finding out more about how the human body worked. And there's a brilliant quote from one testimony from a body snatcher, which says, "A man may make a good living at it if he is a sober man and acts with judgment and supplies the schools."
There's nothing quite like watching a drunk man dig up a body.
Bet that happened.
It's great.
Next question.
Go on.
Digging up a body, that must be illegal, right?
Probably not black and white, but yeah, I'm going to say mostly illegal.
More grey area than you would imagine.
Right.
Corpses weren't viewed as property, so they couldn't be owned or stolen. So body snatching remained kind of like quasi-legal. So the crime was actually being committed against the grave and the land rather than the body itself.
It was more of a trespassing issue than a,
exactly.
than a theft issue.
The rare occasions that resurrectionists were caught, their sentence was relatively light, maybe a public whipping or a sentence for crimes against public moors. But generally, it was treated as sort of an open secret and kind of ignored, like turn a blind eye sort of thing.
It benefited the medical establishment, so I'm on board with that.
It's interesting because if you were caught actually stealing, you could be sent to transportation to Australia.
Yeah.
But if you were caught body snatching, it was kind of a slap on the wrist. So interfering with a grave was a misdemeanour at common law, but not a felony. The most you would get would be a fine and imprisonment. And it was so lucrative that a lot of people ran that risk. It actually became so prevalent that it wasn't unusual for relatives and friends of someone who had just died to watch over the body until it was put in the ground, and then to keep watch over the grave after burial to stop it being violated.
For a moment there, I thought you were going to say that it wasn't unusual for the family to watch over the body until it was buried and then dig it straight back up again and take it to the nearest medical school.
Actually, you know what? Some poor people might have done that. I wouldn't put it past them.
I wouldn't be at all surprised.
Yeah. It also led to the creation of things called mort safes, which is like a big iron cage you put around a coffin. The common slang term for them became jankers, which I think is quite cool. So people would put these giant iron cages around coffins before they went in the ground to stop the resurrection men.
Which is terribly wasteful and not great for the land, I think. I came across this in earlier research, the amount of metal that would go into just covering up these hundreds of thousands of graves over the last few centuries is actually a big, big resource drain.
Really?
Natural burial, people.
We're rapidly running out of space in terms of where we can bury people. And if we started to think of different solutions to that space issue, such as allowing people to be buried standing up rather than lying down, or natural burial, or alkaline hydrolysis, it might reduce the issue we're having in terms of the environmental impact of burial and the lack of space problems we have.
Alkaline hydrolysis is still my favourite for eco-friendliness.
Yeah, absolutely. It's way up there. So back to digging people up for profit.
Hooray! I know who's going to arrive on the scene pretty soon.
Who?
Two of my favourite dudes.
Oh, yes, they will be an anecdote.
Good, good.
Yes, but for now, let's talk about how do you dig up a body without being caught?
With a spade and a ninja.
Kind of, yes.
Okay, how close was I to being exactly correct there?
Spade, yes. Ninja, not really.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh. A spade and a highwayman.
Usually through a network of spies and informers.
Ooh.
You, as a resurrection man, would make friends with the local sexton or gravedigger or the undertaker or local officials, maybe offer them a cut of the proceeds because you'd be making...
I'd ask for the top side.
Ew. Because you'd be making quite a chunk of money. Everyone could be swayed by a little cash in hand. So they'd often go in small gangs at night, you know, you'd need a lookout, with a sort of muffled lantern, and they would usually dig a hole at the head of the grave, sometimes with a wooden spade, because it was quieter than a metal spade.
Ah, crafty.
And people weren't, as we mentioned in Burial Alive, people weren't buried as deep back then, so it would be quite easy to get to the coffin. They'd put a sack over the lid of the coffin, and then sort of lift the top half up, and the weight of the soil on the remaining half of the lid of the coffin would be enough to kind of easily snap the lid open. They'd break the coffin open, slip a rope around the neck of the corpse, like a noose, and yank it out neck first. They would then strip it of its clothing, tie it up, and put it in a sack. And that whole process from beginning the digging to getting the corpse out and in the sack would take about half an hour.
Wow!
Yep.
Speedy.
Very speedy. And it was easier to do that with poor people rather than rich people because their bodies were usually kept in mass graves rather than individual ones. So you didn't have to dig as deep and you could kind of get a whole bunch out really quickly.
I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
Would people do a sort of a batch in a night? Would the resurrection men go and, when you say mass graves, would it be easier because they could yank out half a dozen of these things in an evening?
Yes, I believe so. Also, the mass graves would be left open for longer than rich people's solo graves.
Oh, I
see. Until they sort of got the public money to fill it in. So there'd just be loads of dead bodies lying open to the sky for people to come and snatch as they please, like a little corpse buffet for the anatomists. Lovely.
Lucky guys.
If you want to read what it was like being a resurrectionist, there was a man who wrote in the 1800s a book called The Diary of a Resurrectionist, a man called Joshua Naples, and that is actually available to buy and read. He detailed the graveyards he went to, the institutions he delivered to, how much he was paid, and his drunkenness. And he talks about things like bodies they don't want to pilfer, like putrid ones or ones they think is infected with smallpox, and superstitions they had, like not doing it when it was a full moon, that kind of thing.
Mad stuff.
Yeah. Other methods they had for stealing corpses were things like paying women to pose as grieving relatives so they can claim a body from a workhouse, or bodies taken from dead houses, lichen houses, they take them. Bribes paid to servants of recently deceased employers who were lying in state, although that was a little risky as they were usually on public display before being buried.
Yeah, I can imagine someone trying to sneak up and pinch Lenin and not doing too well.
Yeah, pinch the aristocrats. Some surgeons would not take real cadavers. They take wax ones or artificial ones, plaster casts, that kinds of things. Lots of them still used animals, but lots of them would actually use the bodies of their own patients who had died.
With permission?
Nope.
Just opportunistically?
I think so.
All right.
Because I think a lot of very religious families would not give permission.
Yeah, I would think so. You gotta take it where you can.
So body snatching became such a big business, and it actually became quite awful that people were going in and taking, you know, grieving people's dead relatives and things. That
it's kind of unpleasant when you think about
super
it. Yeah.
Unpleasant. So it got to the point in the early 1800s where people decided that they had to find another way. So the Anatomy Act of 1832 was passed, which basically decriminalised taking the bodies of paupers, and not just criminal bodies.
Just paupers, not real people, though.
Not rich people, no. It didn't say anything about body snatching or selling corpses. It also allowed a person's body to be given up for medical dissection. So this is the introduction of allowing people to donate their body to medical science.
Oh, wonderful. That's the dawn of a new era.
Yeah.
We're happy with that.
It was called anatomical examination, provided that the person concerned hadn't objected. And because a lot of poor people weren't literate, it was very easy to say, oh no, they didn't object. It was fine. Because they couldn't sign anything or read anything to the effect of, I object to being given up for anatomical examination. After the Anatomy Act of 1832 was passed, the trade for body snatching started dwindling, because you could get paupers' bodies, and it had decriminalised it so significantly that over the next 15 years it basically disappeared. Mm. So by the 1850s there were no more resurrection men.
Oh.
Mm, probably a good thing.
They'll be sorely missed.
Will they? So one of the major reasons the Anatomy Act got passed quite quickly through Parliament was because of your two favourite dudes who are about to show up.
Mr. Burke and Mr. Hare.
William Burke and William Hare. They were not resurrection men. They were not body snatchers. They were murderers.
They made bodies. They didn't
exactly.
Take bodies.
Exactly. They did not steal them. And this is one of the reasons body snatching was given such a bad name, was because Burke and Hare essentially fueled fears that people were being murdered and then sold to anatomists and surgeons, because that's what they did. They murdered about 16 people overall and sold them. And they were finally caught, and Burke was sentenced to execution. And he was given to the Anatomical Museum of the Edinburgh Medical School and was dissected, and his skeleton is still available to view there. And then a leather-bound book was made of his skin.
My
which
favourite.
You can see at the Surgeons Hall Museum in Edinburgh. And his death mask is also there as well.
Oh, I forgot about his death mask.
Yeah. Amazing, right? So he was, after death, dissected. William Hare was actually smuggled out of Edinburgh and sort of released into the wild, never to be seen again. seriously, there were no more sightings of him after his release.
He made his way across Europe and became the king of Nairobi, I think.
I don't think that's necessarily true. His...
Well, unknown no more. He's the king of Nairobi. He still is.
Let's make up stories about William Hare. Yeah. Spread those around on our factual podcast.
He's not the king of Nairobi, guys.
That's a brief history of exhumation and some of the most famous stories about it. Today, as I said earlier, we don't really do it anymore unless you need a license for it or the court has ordered it for forensic investigation. It's quite traumatic to dig people up once they're in the ground, so probably not the best idea.
Yeah, it's probably a nasty shock to see exactly what grandma's turned into after a few months.
Well, because we're so shielded from death in our society, it would be to us, but when there used to be open graves with lots of paupers in them just decaying until someone found the time to fill it in. I'm sure people weren't quite as traumatised by it as we might be.
No, people were just like, grandma's gone slimy. It's normal.
Oh, God. And also, being able to donate your body to medical science has been a huge, huge help in terms of preventing illegal digging up of graves. So you can donate your body to medical science and become a cadaver in a medical school, and students will practice on you. As if you ask any doctor, you do have to do anatomy lab, and you do get to practice on a real preserved dead person.
You could be training the doctors of tomorrow, guys. Don't leave our children and grandchildren with incompetent doctors.
God, that feels like a bit of a tangent, really. Incompetent doctors.
A tangent or a direful digression?
Oh my God, we've digressed into the direful digression.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for listening to Morbid Curiosities, a show about the morbidly curious for the curiously morbid.
If you've been enjoying the podcast, we'd love to hear from you and we'd love to talk to you. We tend to put out a weekly question about whatever we've been talking about and then gather answers from far and wide across the internet. So last week's question was, what thing would you like done with your ashes? And we had some absolutely amazing responses.
Yeah, people have been quite enthusiastic about this one.
Lots of trees, lots of people wanting to be mixed in the root balls of trees. Lots of people wanting to be turned into diamonds. Laurie said she wanted to have her husband put her in a very stylish urn, preferably Alexander McQueen. Take her cremains on a trip around the world, scattering a little bit of her everywhere that he goes.
Aww.
She said, with the life insurance money he's going to get, I better get a sweet vacation. And then she said, with the rest, whatever was left, she wanted to be planted with a magnolia tree on the west coast of Canada or New Zealand, and that would be her husband's choice.
Wow.
Maisie Martini said, she wanted to be made into diamonds, but she wanted them to be put on beautiful pasties to be put on display in a burlesque museum, or to be worn by the winner of Miss Exotic World of the Burlesque Hall of Fame, which I think would be a pretty cool alternative to a crown. Al and Vivacity said that they wanted to be mixed into paint and turned into portraits of themselves. Al would particularly like detail, paid attention to the eyes, so they followed people around the room. And Vivacity said she wants it to go over the fireplace over of her brother so that she can continuously watch him after he's gone.
Nice. Not at all creepy, yeah. Horrifying, weird there.
Lots of people wanting to be mixed into fireworks. Someone wanted to be mixed into a cake. Flavia said she wanted to be mixed into a cake to be served at her wake, and the rest maybe compressed into a diamond. But she also said she wanted her tattoo to be removed and preserved first, and maybe something interestingly macabre to be done with her teeth, which I thought was really cool.
Oh, that's beautiful. Yeah. Teeth sculptures are
just nice. Richard said he wanted to have his ashes divided up into about 50 glass vials and handed out to strangers by his son, daughter or grandchild after some play or show about Richard's life, with the line, here, have some of Dad or Granddad. Most people wouldn't believe it, but there's no knowing where they'd end up.
Richard, there's no one quite like you.
And Roxy wanted to be mixed in with glitter and then her loved ones would never be rid of her. Because glitter never disappears. And my favourite one was sent in by Kelly, who said her husband wants his ashes to be pressed into a record and she wants to be made into a diamond needle for a record player. And then they'd have a beautiful wooden boxed record player made. And then when they die, they could still make sweet music together.
That's nauseatingly sweet.
Isn't that adorable?
Yeah, that is.
That was fab. So, what's this week's question going
to
be?
If you knew that your grave was going to be visited by resurrection men, what surprise would you leave under the lid for them?
Oh my God. Brilliant.
It could be a delightful surprise. It could be a firework to go off in their face as soon as the lid comes off. Just let us know what trap or treat you would put in your coffin.
Very apt for Halloween. Trick or treat, grave robber. Trick or treat.
Let us know. You can tweet at us with the hashtag MorbidCurioCast.
At Jim Crack Shows on Twitter. You can find us on Facebook at
facebook.com/JimCrackProductions1. That's a numeral one, not spelled O-N-E.
You can find us on Instagram at Jim Crack Productions. And you can also visit our website,
JimCrackProductions.com.
Excellent. You can also see our shows. We have so many shows coming up. We have Cabaret Roulette this week. Wednesday, come see us at Cabaret Roulette.
Whoa! When this goes to press, we will have a show on yesterday called Jim Crackery. That will be playing again on the 23rd of October. Our second show will be the third Sunday in October.
Yes, at Crazy Cox, Brasserie Zedel.
In Piccadilly.
London's Piccadilly. We have tons more shows coming up, which we'll tell you about nearer the time. Apothecary was awesome.
Apothecary was awesome. Hopefully really fun. You'll see me at Apothecary Cabaret more next year.
Yeah, that would be great.
Okay, Rosie, let's get on with the second half of the show. It's my turn.
That was a real digression.
A real direful digression, but on we go with the letter F. Rosie, I feel terrible. How do I look?
Heavens preserve me. You look like something's died.
The only way you'll be preserved is in formaldehyde.
That's sinister.
Dedicated video game fans, you're welcome.
What's that from?
The Curse of Monkey Island. My topic this week is formaldehyde.
What is formaldehyde?
What is formaldehyde indeed? It's not embalming fluid. Embalming fluid is a mixture of formalin and water. And formalin is a liquid form of formaldehyde, which is a gas. So formaldehyde is a naturally occurring organic compound with the chemical structure CH2O. Just made up of carbon, hydrogen and oxygen, like most of the atoms in the body. It's a colourless but strong-smelling gas, and it's all over the place. It really is everywhere. It's created by most living things as a byproduct of metabolism. It's very dangerous. It'll make people very, very ill in concentrations of more than about 0.1 parts in a million.
Whoa.
It's a carcinogen. It kills most bacteria, which is why it's very useful as a disinfectant. And about 10 millilitres of it will kill an adult human. So it's not to be messed with. It's widely used. Its industrial applications are far and wide. The odds are overwhelming that if you look around you, wherever you are right now, if you look around you, you'll be looking at something that was created using formaldehyde.
I didn't realise it was so common. But what does this have to do with death?
Formaldehyde is the key ingredient in formalin, which in turn, as I mentioned, is the key ingredient in embalming fluid.
Ah.
And what I'm going to be talking about today is the practice of embalming. Now, technically, the earliest historical records we have of some sort of embalming, and I'm saying that in inverted commas because it's not the same as the process which we recognise as embalming today, but the earliest records date to about 6000 BCE. And that's a South American culture called the Chinchorro in Chile and Peru. You look disappointed.
I thought you were going to talk about mummies. I love talking about mummies.
Straight on to mummies. That's,
yay!
That's the sort of... I'm not going to talk about them too long. So embalming was being practiced by the ancient Egyptians. It's technically just the practice of working to preserve a dead body. They would do it by taking out the organs and making you all leathery. Formaldehyde, the gas, was first reported in 1859 by a Russian chemist called Alexander Butlerov, and was conclusively identified 10 years later by a German chemist, a very important man, this German chemist called August Wilhelm von Hofmann. And its properties were quickly identified, specifically that of its use as a preservative. Formalin was developed, and a certain event gave rise in particular to a public interest in it, a public interest in the usefulness of preserving a body for longer than you would expect it to be preserved after death.
The American Civil War.
The American Civil War. People wanted to see their fallen family members.
Well, and also way more soldiers died in that war than had really ever died in a war before. And particularly a lot of them were far away from home. So a lot of family members wanted them shipped back in some kind of condition.
But they didn't want them to come back just a pile of goo and bones.
Yeah, there's actually some really interesting and quite heartbreaking accounts of the poor soldiers that had to sort through the dead and figure out, identify them and ship them back. And it took them weeks and weeks and weeks. And some of them were not in a preservation-y state when they got to them. And a lot of people had a lot of post-traumatic stress disorder from this ordeal.
I think when the idea of embalming first hit, people didn't realise quite what it could do. And there seems to have been this sort of impression that a body would just be restored to its once pristine state as soon as you put embalming fluid in it.
Yeah.
You really don't have that much time.
No, and these poor soldiers had to still find their fallen comrades, identify them and ship them back after they'd been out lying on a battlefield for several weeks sometimes.
Eep!
Yeah, it's pretty grim. So you say we don't have much time. How do you actually go about embalming someone? How quickly do you need to get it done?
Well, it's a matter of days, depending on whether or not you have access to a mortuary freezer, of course. Certainly within the first couple of days is when you would need to get to work if embalming fluid were to do its job properly.
Well, especially after our episode on decomposition, you know that within the first 24 hours, there's quite a few compositional changes that happen in the body. And I'm sure a mortuary freezer could slow those down, but stuffs are changing.
So we want to get to work as fast as we possibly can. So here we are in the mortuary, in the embalming room. Welcome. How does it look?
Cold and shiny. Very clean.
So we're going to wheel in a body. What's the body's name, Rosie?
Jimothy.
So we're going to wheel in Jimothy, and we're going to bring him over to our embalming table.
Oh, Jimothy, I barely knew you.
The first thing we're going to do is we're going to clean Jimothy. We're going to rub him down with a special soap, and we're going to use a very powerful disinfectant to clean out Jimothy's mouth, eyes, nose, and other orifices. Then we're going to give Jimmy a bit of a shave. Women and children will be shaved, as well as men, to remove peach fuzz. This is with a view to exactly how they're going to look in the open casket, which is presumably why we're embalming them. On the subject of hair, I'm gonna be myth-busting as we go through the process of embalming here. Hair does not continue to grow after death, nor do nails. That idea comes from reports of resurrection mend bodies, where it looks like the hair has extended out and the nails as well have extended out from the body. That is, in fact, a result of the skin drying out, pulling back, and giving the impression that the hair and nails are longer than they were at death. Now it's time for a massage. Having been shaved, the body is going to be massaged all over, quite thoroughly. And the reason for that is to break, in inverted commas, rigor mortis and loosen up the muscles. This is because we're going to send embalming fluid through those muscles, and the stiffness in them would get in the way of the smooth flow of embalming fluid around the body. Next up, we're going to close up the mouth and eyes. This is a particularly delicate part of the operation. The eyelids, once the eyes are gone, the eyelids kind of droop in. They sink. Which is kind of gross to think of.
Because the eyes collapse. We learned about that in decomposition.
Yeah, the eyes collapse pretty soon.
Because there's no blood pressure, so they deflate.
So we're going to fill them out, maybe with some cotton wool. And we're going to put in something called eye caps, which are very large contact lens-shaped things with spikes in them, which you just hook into the inside of the eyelids to keep the eyes closed. A similar thing called an injector gun can be used to set the mouth closed. The mouth can also be sewn shut by passing a needle through the gums and then back out through the septum so that there's no visible hole. Next up, we're going to put a drain tube into Jimothy. Now, we can insert this into one of Jimothy's veins or directly into his heart. This is so that when the embalming fluid starts going into the body, the blood can come out. Having inserted a drain tube into a vein, we're going to insert a cannula into the artery. It's usually either in the neck or in the femur. The cannula which you've inserted in there will now be hooked up to an embalming machine, which, when we switch it on, is going to pump about 2 gallons of fluid through the body. About 16 ounces of embalming fluid will be mixed into those 2 gallons of water. We're going to keep massaging the limbs. This is to keep the blood moving. Obviously, because the circulatory system is circulatory, with the embalming fluid moving through one set of arteries, it's going to push blood out as it goes, and the entire body will be fed with this embalming fluid.
I've heard that embalming fluid also usually has a colour tinge to it in order to offset the effects of pallor mortis, to sort of pinken up the body and make it look more living-y again.
That's right. It's something that I was going to touch on later. The chemical makeup of embalming fluid, of formalin, does include various additives, including dyes.
Yeah.
Because if you pump the body full of a clear liquid, it would look like
creepy.
Aquaman.
Creepy. not alive. And I'm sure the idea of embalming and this kind of preservation is to make them look sleeping and less dead.
That's something we can mention in passing, is that the idea of embalming is usually with a view to what we're going to see in the open casket. What we want to see in the open casket is a close likeness of the person as they were alive, at peace, and in a healthy condition. This is a prime example of where the funeral is for the living, not for the dead.
Yeah.
So where were we? We've switched on this embalming machine, and we're massaging the limbs as we go. so that embalming fluid can flow healthily throughout the body. I say healthily, 10 millilitres of it would kill you. The blood, which is being pushed out, is going out through the drain tube, which is being opened occasionally to relieve pressure. Pressure will build up as you do this, and actually if you watch a body being embalmed, you can see the veins bulging. Ew, as you go.
Creepy.
It is creepy, but it's how the embalmer knows that it's time to open the drain tube and let a little of the blood out. So gradually the pressure will be reduced by the machine until about 20% of the fluid is left in the machine out of the body, at which point that cannula, which was inserted into either the neck or the femur, will be turned around, as it were. It'll be put into the other open end of the artery, which has been nicked open. And the remaining 20% of that embalming fluid will fill up either the lower leg, if the cannula was put into the femur, or the head, if it was put into the neck.
Of course, because it wouldn't go all the way up.
That's right, because you have severed the respiratory system when you open up an artery.
Of course.
However, we ain't done yet.
Oh no.
There are hollow organs in the body.
Yeah.
And this is something I'm going to mention. Another myth I'm going to bust as we go. Embalming does not involve the removal of organs.
Oh.
No organs will be taken out of you when you're embalmed. In fact, if you are autopsied and subsequently embalmed, the autopsyman, will replace all of your organs. They'll be taken out, biopsied, whatever procedures need to be done on them, and then they'll actually be shoved back into the body. Something called a trocar is then going to be used to aspirate the organs. A little way above and a little way to the left of your belly button, mm-hmm. going to make another incision, and then we're going to feed other tools in there to aspirate, to empty out the hollow organs, the stomach, kidneys, bladder, so on, of gases and bacterial buildup which have happened after death. And then we're going to flood those full of embalming fluid. Thusly, we'll have filled out all of the hollow space inside the body with a preservative, so it's ready to be sealed up, cleaned, have makeup applied, extensive makeup applied, because while the embalming fluid does help with palmortis, it doesn't completely restore you to your once pink luster. So that's the modern process, as we have it, of embalming with formaldehyde.
Or formalin.
Or formalin, rather. If it were a surgical procedure on a living body, it would actually be considered minimally invasive. It's a laparoscopic or keyhole surgery procedure, which makes sense, being that the objective is to keep the body looking as pristine as it possibly can. That said, it's a big mistake to think of formaldehyde or formalin as harmless. It's a very, very, very powerful carcinogen, and while it is naturally produced by most living things, it's naturally produced in minimal quantities, and this stuff can really make you sick. Minimal exposure to it can leave you with nosebleeds, itching eyes, sore gums, and a bevy of other really, really unpleasant side effects. I'm just going to leave you with one quick anecdote from the early history of embalming, which is about a dentist, a man called Martin van Butchel. We're going back to 1775 here, so we are predating formaldehyde and formalin, so this is a completely different form of preservation. But when this dentist's wife, Mary, died on January 14th, 1775, he decided to have her embalmed and turned her into an attraction in order to draw more customers.
My God.
He,
That's terrible.
I just enjoy this story as a precursor to the pleasant process of embalming that we have today. He injected her body with preservatives and colour additives to give, in inverted commas here, a glow to the corpse's cheeks. She replaced his wife's eyes with glass eyes, dressed her in a fine lace gown, embedded her in a layer of plaster of Paris, and placed in a glass-topped coffin. For some reason, this was considered an advert for a dentist.
That's mental.
I don't fully understand it, but it would get your attention, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
It was on display in the window of his home, and a lot of Londoners came to see the body. A rumour, quite possibly started by Butchel himself, claimed that his wife's marriage certificate had specified that Van Butchel would only have control over her estate after her death for as long as her body was kept unburied. Presumably she was hoping that after a while she'd just wake up again.
Poor Mary Van Butchel is all I will say on that point.
So there we have a very brief overview of formaldehyde, formalin, and the embalming process as we have it today. To learn more, watch 6 Feet Under.
Yeah, 6 Feet Under. Well, just watch it in general because it's a brilliant, brilliant show.
But it's also a very well-researched show.
Yeah, it's really well put together. I have my qualms with preservation.
As do I.
But it is still an option for you after you're gone, if that's how you would like to be treated after you're gone.
So, folks, there we have it. E and F in the Cabinet of Death.
Exhumation and formaldehyde.
Thank you so much for listening.
It's been really, really fun yet again to talk about these really interesting aspects of what happens to us after we're gone.
Don't forget our audience question for the week. What trick or treat would you leave in your coffin for resurrection men to find when they dig you up?
Brilliant. I can't wait to see the answers on this one.
Yeah, this should be a good one.
If you would like to give us an answer, tweet us at JimCrackShows on Twitter with the hashtag
MorbidCurioCast. You can find us on Facebook at
www.facebook.com/JimCrackProductions1, numeral one, not O-N-E.
On Instagram at
JimCrackProductions.
Or on our personal website at
JimCrackProductions.com. We have a contact form. Drop us an email. Please do. It'd be lovely to hear from you. I have been your host, Rosie Cole.
I have been your other host, George Colley. Until next time,
stay morbid
and stay curious.